It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at the Wisconsin industries that are getting hit the hardest by retaliatory tariffs from Canada. First, we check in on the top stories of the week in national politics. President Trump clarified remarks he made about Russian election meddling after backlash from both parties. The House and Senate are starting to reconcile their versions of the farm bill, and conservative Republicans in the House want to start impeachment proceedings for Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Our question for you this week, do you think getting rid of the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein would be a good idea? Do you see signs of bias in how the Justice Department is handling the investigation into Russian campaign interference? Or do you think the probe should continue to its conclusion? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Daniel Neuhauser is a staff correspondent for the National Journal. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
I want to give a listen here at the White House yesterday. President Trump tried to clarify remarks that he made at a press conference with Russian President Vladimir Putin, where he appeared to accept Putin's denial of Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Here he is with that yesterday.
Let me be totally clear in saying that, and I've said this many times, I accept our intelligence community's conclusion that Russia's meddling in the 2016 election took place. Could be other people also. There's a lot of people out there.
Well, take us back through the backlash to the president's initial comments saying, hey, he heard from Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, he heard from Vladimir Putin, he had confidence in both, and now he's sort of walking that back yesterday. What do you make of that, Dan?
Yeah, well, Republicans on Capitol Hill, for the most part, were completely dismayed by the president's seemingly weak position standing next to Putin in Helsinki. They put out a lot of statements basically chastising or saying, you know, the president shouldn't have appeared that way and that he should confirm what his own intelligence community is saying him rather than listening to Vladimir Putin. But as far as taking any action beyond that, as far as doing anything substantive like a censure or any kind of legislation or even a House resolution affirming their support for the intelligence community, that seems to be a step too far for a congressional Republican who basically feel like they cannot they can't be on the wrong side of this Republican president for fear of backlash from the Republican base.
And the president's explanation was that he said would instead of wouldn't when he was talking about whether he thought Russia was responsible for campaign interference in 2016. Did that give an out, at least for some congressional Republicans?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, some people said, well, okay, that's good enough for me. But I think the key here is that people who were looking for an out found it, and other people remain skeptical. And then just today, the president was asked whether he thinks that Russia is still meddling, and he said no. And, of course, the intelligence community believes that they still are. And then Sarah Sanders, his press secretary, came out and said, well, he wasn't saying no to the question. He was saying no to answering the question. He didn't want to answer the question. So there continues to be these mixed messages coming from the White House. Perhaps you can chalk some of this up to the president's interesting and unique communication style. But certainly there is a lot here on Capitol Hill left to be desired.
And in that bit that we heard from yesterday, the president said he agrees with the intelligence community about Russian interference. That far, he's agreeing with his intelligence community. And then he said, could be other people. There's a lot of people out there. So he left this wiggle room in some ways.
Yeah, well, he just seems very uncomfortable with changing positions. I think there's some thought that it makes him seem, you know, weak or susceptible to attacks from the press or from his own critics. And so what he has been saying, I mean, you remember famously he said it could be like some 400-pound guy sitting at a computer, which obviously there's no intelligence indicating that at all. All the intelligence indicates that this is state-sponsored Russian attacks on our election integrity. But you know, he ad-libbed that second part, basically saying, well, it could be other people, when in fact the intelligence community has been pretty clear that it's that it's not other people.
And this all came after the president's meeting with NATO and a rocky relationship there. And then the president had said on Fox News after the Putin conversation, the issue of the country of Montenegro, one of the newer, smaller members of NATO, came up. The president expressed concern that they would be aggressive and create an incident with Russia, and it wouldn't be worth it, in effect, for the United States to come to the defense of a NATO partner. And that, from foreign policy people, has raised some eyebrows.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this all... big picture, it appears to people here on the Hill that the president is aligning himself with autocratic-leaning, strongman people with dictatorial tendencies, and turning his back on our own allies. In another interview, he called the EU a foe, things like that. It's just not what people are used to seeing here from an American president, let alone a Republican president, when the Republican Party ostensibly tries to be, the party of peace through strength, the party of Reagan, who famously stood up to Gorbachev and Russian leaders during the Soviet era. So it's putting Republicans here on the Hill in a pretty tough position where they feel, again, beholden to Trump because he has completely captured the Republican base. They feel like there's little that they can substantively do, because he doesn't listen to them anyway, but they do feel they feel in disagreement with him. They believe in NATO. They do believe that Putin has been an enemy and has been adversarial to the United States. So we'll see how this manifests going forward. But as for now, they have done very little. Republicans have done very little on the Hill other than issue a few statements to try to rebuke the president.
Talking to Dan Neuhauser, staff correspondent for the National Journal, and our weekly roundup of national news. Moving over to Congress, but on a related issue, some conservative Republicans in the U.S. House are looking, they say, to impeach Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Who is behind this? What are their criticisms of Rosenstein?
So this is originating from the House Freedom Caucus. Famously, the group that split away from an already conservative group here because they wanted to be even more conservative, if not policy-wise, then tactically. They agree in these, tough, strong-handed tactics to try to push even their own conference further to the right. They were the same people who were behind the ultimately failed attempt to impeach IRS Commissioner John Koskinen. And now they are coming for Rod Rosenstein's head. What they've said is that Congress has been trying to compel the DOJ to release certain documents related to the Russia investigation and the investigation into the Clinton email server, things like surveillance of former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. And so they don't feel like they're getting enough documents, and so they're floating this impeachment motion. I don't know if they're ultimately going to go through with it, but they have been as close as standing on the House floor with it. Representative Mark Meadows, the chairman of this group, he was standing on the House floor last Friday with this motion in his hand, ready to file it, and then he ultimately didn't. So whether some of that is for show, to try to put pressure on Rosenstein, or maybe just to get news articles out there about it, that's a thought. But maybe they ultimately will go through with this. What they have settled on this week is to write a letter to the Department of Justice Inspector General, asking them to look into the whether or not Rosenstein is agreeing with these document subpoenas. So again, we'll see exactly how far this goes. But there is not a lot of support, even among fellow Republicans, to do this. Trey Gowdy, Paul Ryan, they've been pretty happy with how Rosenstein has been handing documents over. So I don't think ultimately this would have enough support to pass, even if it did get filed.
Dan Neuhauser is with us, correspondent at the National Journal, looking at the week in national politics, and you can join in at 800-642-1123. What do you think of this idea advanced by some conservative House Republicans of impeaching the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, the person overseeing the Mueller probe? Do President Trump and conservative Republicans have a point when they say the Justice Department is tainted by political bias? Or do you think the probe should continue with Rosenstein overseeing it? What do you think? Is this a tactic, a stunt, or a good idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We continue our conversation with Dan Neuhauser from the National Journal. We're looking at some of the top stories in political news from around the nation. We'll go to your calls now on our question this week about the idea of impeaching the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein. Albert is with us in Hub City. Albert, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I've been watching this pretty close, and Congress, the Republicans in Congress has been after everybody they can go after, and now they figure they can go after Robert with Rosenstein. I think they just want to get that. They want to end the Mueller probe because they don't want to find out the truth about what Mueller has got. And I believe the Congress, Republicans in Congress, are just as crooked as the President Trump is.
Albert, thanks a lot for the call. Dan, do you think Republicans in Congress are unanimous about the idea of wanting to put an end to the Mueller probe, as Albert's suggesting?
They're absolutely not unanimous about it. There are numerous Republicans, including the leadership, who have been unequivocal in saying that the Mueller probe should continue. But Albert is right in pointing out that Rosenstein, a vote against Rosenstein or Trump firing Rosenstein would be seen as an attack on the Mueller probe, because don't forget here, now Rosenstein is the only in charge of the Mueller probe because Attorney General Sessions recused himself of anything to do with Russia. So that puts Rosenstein as the next man up. He's the deputy attorney general. He's a career guy. He doesn't have any particular allegiances to Trump one way or the other. So to have somebody who's seen as an impartial arbiter, removed, that would open up for the position for Trump to install somebody there who would be less sympathetic to Mueller, who would not, want to allow that probe to go on. And I think that would be seen as the real red line here by a lot of Republicans, including the congressional leadership. Now, again, whether that would actually lead to them doing anything, I can't know, because everything that has happened so far, where it seems as if the president has crossed some sort of a red line, there's been not much of a response from Congress, again, other than maybe a statement or so here and there. It would be well established that would set off some sort of a constitutional crisis, and nobody wants to head in that direction.
Albert, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Barb in Heartland. Barb, hi.
Hi. I think this is a ploy. I think this is just partisan tricks again. If we allow this to, if the world, if this country allows this to happen, it's just another indication of the decay of our democracy. Allowing these people to do this, these congressional leaders, I don't know what's going on with the people in this country that they can't understand. These people are crazy, and this guy is crazy in office. We got to stop it.
Barb, thanks for the call. Even if this doesn't go anywhere, Dan, even if an impeachment didn't do anything, it didn't even get voted on, is it part of, you think, a PR war, as Barb is suggesting, trying to take some of the heat off the Trump administration?
Yeah, maybe that, or maybe even floating the idea as sort of a trial balloon. Because remember, Trump himself has openly mused about firing Rosenstein. I mean, he tweeted about it. He said maybe he should go. If there is some support for the idea, that is, if the Freedom Caucus can float the idea and then it gains grassroots support and it becomes something that there's a lot of backing behind from the Republican base, that would maybe enable Trump to do it on his own. I mean, he doesn't need the Freedom Caucus to do this. He could fire Rosenstein pretty much any time. The problem, though, of course, like I just said, is that would be probably the most controversial thing he has ever done in his presidency, and it would turn a lot of people in his party potentially against him.
Thanks for that call, Barb. We go next to James with us in Fall Creek. James, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I think the media, as well as Rosenstein and Mueller and the whole body is missing is the bias of the announcement that Trump was going to Russia. Certainly the president was briefed before, 2 days before, but the indictment itself will never result in people going to court because these are people in Russia. And why that announcement or why that announcement had to be made in just before he leaves for a trip, 2 days, there is so much bias there that the media surely must recognize it.
James, thanks for the call. Dan, James questioning the timing of these indictments against these Russian military intelligence officials right before the president meets with the Russian president.
Well, yeah, there was some reporting and some thought that the timing of that was intended to put pressure on Trump, but there has been some subsequent reporting and statements from the White House saying that Trump actually was briefed on that before he left and gave the okay for them to put out those statements. And I'll push back on another thing. There have been a lot of indictments against people who are in Russia who will never probably see justice in this country for those things because they're not going to be extradited. But there has been one arrest here, Maria Butina, who is in prison as we speak and awaiting a trial, that there is it's seemingly some concrete accountability there. Of course, let's not forget, there are several people who were associated with the Trump campaign, most notably Paul Manafort, who have also been brought up on charges stemming from the Mueller probe.
James, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Dan Neuhauser with the National Journal. It's our weekly roundup of national politics. Want to move on to another issue or two before we run out of time, Dan. This one with the Wisconsin connection, the idea of a vote in Congress to abolish ICE, Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan had introduced a bill that would abolish it. House Republicans are scrapping a plan to bring that to the floor for a vote. Give us some background on that.
So actually, this is very timely because they just voted on this about 15 minutes ago. Not this bill, but what they did is they scaled it back to a resolution in support of ICE. So at first, the abolish ICE idea has become very resonant on the left, on the progressive left, as a response to some of the horrific treatment of immigrants that we've been seeing coming out in news stories. A lot of the progressive left and members of Congress here, too, have been saying, well, we need to scrap ICE altogether. Now, Republicans said, if that's how you feel, why don't we test how popular that theory is in your caucus? And so what they had planned to do, what they wanted to do, was bring it to the floor for a vote put Democrats on the record. Republicans think this is actually a political winner for them. Because it seems too extreme for most Americans, for independent voters, the kinds of voters that you need to vote for you beyond just your party base. That plan was ultimately scrapped because Democrats indicated that they were going to encourage their members to vote neither yes or no. You could just vote present, essentially saying, yes, I'm here, but I'm not taking a position on this. And Democrats, including Mark Pocan, said, well, that's what we're going to do because we're not going to let Republicans dictate to us how and when we vote on our bills, and we're not going to indulge them in a vote that's just a messaging vote. So instead, today, Republicans brought up a resolution supporting ICE, and most Democrats did vote present, but a lot of them didn't. In fact, there were about a dozen or so Democrats who voted against the measure, indicating that they do not support ICE. Mark Pocan was not one of them. And then there were, that was about maybe two dozen members who voted against it, and about a dozen who voted for it, 18 to be exact. One of them, a Wisconsinite, Ron Kind, who's a pretty moderate Democrat. So even there in your Wisconsin delegation, you can see a split with Mark Pocan being with the Abolish ICE movement against ICE, but also with House leadership in saying, you know, we're not going to let Democrats pin us in a corner on this. And then Ron Kind, saying that he supports ICE, but that he and even if this bill comes to the floor on Republicans' terms, he's going to vote to support ICE.
And I want to turn to the Farm Bill. Slowly, this huge piece of legislation slowly making its way through Congress. Versions have passed, I understand, in the House and the Senate. But now those are two different versions. They need to be reconciled. Where are we on that?
So they just voted as well to go to conference here in the House. So we're expecting that's not going to happen next week. And then there's a break for all of August. So September is going to be a busy month where they have a lot of spending bills to take care of. And the Farm Bill needs to be done by the end of that month, too. The two biggest issues that I'm keeping an eye on are, of course, the expanded work requirements that Republicans have included in the House bill, which are not in the Senate bill and which Democrats vehemently oppose. There are already work requirements for people who are getting food stamps, supplemental nutrition assistance. But this would deepen the requirements, basically allowing, you know, states can go further up to 30 hours a week of work or training programs. And this would federally mandate that anybody, for workers up to 60 years old, to have to prove every month that they worked or participated in a work program for at least 20 hours a week or qualified for an exemption. So Democrats think that would just take some of these the food stamps out of the mouths of children who are the children of some of these people who would be subject to these work requirements. And so they're not going to go for that. And of course, this bill would need 60 votes in the Senate to pass. So that's really going to be an issue. The final issue I'll say that I'm keeping an eye on is a bill, an amendment that is in the Senate version of the bill that would essentially limit the amount of subsidies that certain farms can get. That's not in the House bill. And even House Republican Agriculture Chairman Mike Conaway says he's not for it because this is a bad time with all the tariffs going on and with farmers already struggling, weather and other things that taking subsidies away from farmers, this is not a good time to do it.
Dan, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime. Thank you.
Daniel Neuhauser is a correspondent for the National Journal. He was with us for our weekly checkup on the top news in national politics. American businesses are feeling the effects of the Trump administration's trade disputes with countries around the world. Here on Central Time, we recently talked to Jeff Schwager, president of Sartori Cheese in Plymouth, Wisconsin, about what it means to be making and selling a product with so much uncertainty about tariffs and prices.
Uncertainty is the killer. I mean, we're sitting on inventory from cheese we made a year ago that we thought was going to, you know, when we made it, there were certain trade rules in place. Now, we don't know when we look at these tariffs, are they going to be here for a month? Are they going to be here for 3 months, 3 years? Because we've got to make decisions on product we make today for what we're going to need a year from now.
Now, 18 days into tariffs for one of our biggest trading partners, we take a closer look at the effects of retaliatory tariffs from Canada on businesses here in Wisconsin. Scott Gordon is the associate editor of wiscontext.org. You can find his recent piece there titled, "Which Wisconsin Exports Are Canada's Tariffs Hitting the Hardest?" Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
How important of a trading partner is Canada to us Wisconsin?
How important? Canada is Wisconsin's biggest destination for international exports. It's not even close. Mexico is second and, you know, accounts for maybe half as many exports. So It is a big deal.
What kind of numbers are we talking about as far as dollar amounts per year or over a longer period, whatever you got?
Well, every year this decade, Wisconsin has exported, you know, $6 billion or more, sometimes quite a bit more, in different goods to Canada. So it's, you know, it's a significant export market for the state, and that covers a lot of different kinds of products and a lot of different industries.
We hear a lot about trade balance between the United States and other countries. How about Wisconsin and Canada? Are we selling them more than they're selling us?
Actually, we are. Yeah. Wisconsin, you know, imports about $4 million of goods from Canada in a given year, versus exporting about $6 billion.
And give us an idea of the kinds of products before we dig into the tariffs and which ones they specifically hit. Broad strokes, what are we selling to Canada?
Well, agriculture is a big one, of course. There's, you know, a generally more than $1 billion in agricultural trade going back and forth between Canada and Wisconsin most years. Paper is a big one. You know, Wisconsin still has a pretty significant paper industry. You know, but it's really all over the map when you get down to it. You know, all kinds of different products, you know, including some aluminum and steel, which are a central issue of this whole trade war between the U.S. and Canada.
And that takes us to the new tariffs now. And the story so far, the Trump administration says, okay, steel and aluminum tariffs on just about everybody, including Canada. That's a controversial part. Canada says, okay, we're going to impose tariffs on a bunch of American products coming up north of the border. How big a hit, you know, you mentioned the amount of $6 billion a year Wisconsin exports going to Canada. How much of that is those tariffs are targeted toward the stuff we're selling them from Wisconsin?
So we kind of looked at information about all the product categories that Canada is targeting with its new tariffs and all the stuff that Wisconsin has exported to Canada over the past decade or so. And if you kind of add up what we've exported that falls under those categories, you know, it would add up to a bit more than $6 billion, you know, over the past decade. So it's about 8.5%, I think we found, of, you know, our overall exports to Canada, if you added it up that way.
As we dig into the kinds of goods, Canada went to the World Customs Organization's Harmonized Commodity Description and Coding System. Now, this, you got to look at this, I guess. This would be some fine insomnia reading, I guess, to help us fall asleep. This is how international trading partners put a product into a category.
Yes, and it's just a mind-numbing list, basically, of different very kind of granular product categories, and it's kind of esoteric, but the idea is that, I guess, it kind of gives everyone a common language to talk about when they're looking at, you know, thousands of different kinds of things that are being traded on any given day around the world.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext, he wrote about Canadian tariffs and how they might affect us here in Wisconsin. Scott, let's dig into those categories now, and which Wisconsin products will feel the heaviest hit from these Canadian tariffs?
Well, of course, you know, one of the central parts of all this this trade war stuff is aluminum and steel, and the retaliatory tariffs on aluminum and steel do impact Wisconsin a bit. But, you know, Canada also went a lot further than that and got into all kinds of other product categories. And the one where it's probably going to hit the state hardest is paper. You know, Wisconsin still has a significant paper industry, and that exports a lot of products. And you know, Canada targeted a bunch of different kinds of things within that rubric.
Right. And when I think of paper, I think of, you know, a ream of paper you'd buy to put in your printer. No, we're talking like products made of paper. What kind of thing?
Oh, sure. Yeah. All kinds of things, you know, from greeting cards to playing cards to, you know, to tissues and things like that. So it's really all over the map and you know, strikes, you know, obviously deliberately at some really important categories. You know, a close second is all kinds of different food and agricultural products that Wisconsin sends to Canada, you know, ranging from yogurt to, you know, canned things and processed things.
Cucumbers were on the list, I saw.
Cucumbers were on the list, yes.
Do you know, do we sell a lot of Wisconsin cucumbers to Canada? I don't want to make light of that. That would have been a surprise to me, but I don't know.
Rob, I think we do send them some cucumbers, but I would have to look over my big,
it's not
big
one of our
spreadsheet
key things.
Of things that that I assembled for this.
Sorry, that was just a personal curiosity item. Okay, so we've got paper, we've got food products. Any other iconic or important products here in Wisconsin that are getting tariffs slapped on them?
I mean, it's really, you know, kind of a whole range of things. There's a category for waters that are, it says mineral and aerated or sweetened or flavored, and that obviously would include things like LaCroix water and Clarbrune. Although off the top of my head, I'm not sure how much of that stuff is still made here, but that's obviously something that's closely associated with Wisconsin. There's some impact on maple syrup and other things like that. But I think that the takeaway here is just the wide range of different fronts on which this could impact Wisconsin's export economy.
As we've heard tariff wars with Canada and with other countries and regions like the European Union, some countries have targeted places that voted for Donald Trump or that have key congressional supporters like Wisconsin with Paul Ryan, Kentucky with Mitch McConnell. I mean, does this look like Wisconsin targeted in some ways?
Sure. And I mean, these new tariffs that Canada announced are obviously meant to kind of strike at a lot of different places and a lot of different industries. But, you know, if you wanted to kind of put the screws to Wisconsin in terms of our exports, this would be a pretty good starting point. You know, like I said, this accounts for categories that have made up about 8.5% of our exports to Canada over the past 10 years. And, you know, that's not an insignificant amount when you're, especially when they're kind of targeting things all over the place.
Hey, we'll leave it there. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That was Scott Gordon, associate editor of WisContext.org, with us to talk about his recent piece looking into which of the state's industries are feeling the pain from Canadian tariffs. If you want to hear more about how the Canadian trade dispute is affecting businesses in Wisconsin and Canada, check out a co-production we did last Sunday with CBC's Cross Country Checkup. You can find that online at WPR.org. Some immigrants who were recruited to join the U.S. military are being discharged. These immigrants had believed that their military service would be an expedited pathway to getting citizenship. Attorney Margaret Stock is a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve Military Police Corps. She's the author of the book Immigration Law and the Military, and she's the principal attorney at Cascadia Cross-Border Law in Anchorage, Alaska. She talked to Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson yesterday.
How long has it been possible for immigrants to pursue citizenship through military service?
It's been possible for more than 100 years. Immigrants began doing this during the Civil War era, and then Congress passed a law dating back to World War I that specifically authorizes immigrants who served during wartime to get citizenship on an expedited basis.
And have there been any changes or additions or subtractions to that law and practice in recent decades?
Well, the law has not changed. However, the Department of Defense recently altered the law through a set of internal memos. Frankly, that's not supposed to be lawful. The Department of Defense is not supposed to be able to change a law using internal memos. But recently, DOD decided that they no longer wanted immigrants to be able to get expedited citizenship through honorable military wartime service. So that DOD has made it much more difficult for immigrants to apply for citizenship and to get citizenship.
And we'll go into the details of what's going on right now, but as it's been practice and law for the last several decades, what does a person have to do in order to be eligible to enlist if you're not already a U.S. citizen?
Eligibility for enlistment is now controlled by a statute, again, passed by Congress. Congress said that you have to be a U.S. citizen, a U.S. national. You have to be from one of three Pacific islands that the U.S. has treaties with. Their nationals are allowed to join the U.S. military without any restrictions. Or you have to have a green card in order to join the United States military. Now, many years ago, anybody living in the United States could join the U.S. military. So during the Vietnam War, for example, the United States military drafted unauthorized immigrant men, and they were drafted into the U.S. military. They went to Vietnam. They served in Vietnam. That was also true in all prior wars as well. But since 9/11, the military has only allowed people to join if they have a green card or they're otherwise qualified to join under a special program. But generally speaking, to get into the military today, you have to have at least a green card.
And for those who are not familiar with the process, what do you have to do to get a green card?
In order to get a green card, you have to go through an extensive process of filing the paperwork to get a green card. You have to qualify for one, and it's very difficult for most people in the world to qualify to get a green card. You have to pay fees to the government. You have to undergo an extensive set of background checks to make sure you're not a criminal or terrorist or national security threat. And then once you go through that extensive process, if you qualify, you're given a green card, and then you can join the United States military.
So do we know how many people are currently enlisted who are in this category of not yet being a U.S. citizen, but having been under the impression that they would be able to pursue that as a result of their military service?
Well, we don't have exact numbers, and it's changed recently. Recently, the Department of Defense made it much more difficult for a person to join the military. If they have a green card, they have instituted brand new background checks for green card holders. These background checks don't apply to U.S. citizens who join the military, but they take a long time. So a lot of people who are now joining the military with green cards can't go to their training. They can't ship out to training. They have to complete brand new background checks that DOG just ordered last October. In the past, about 4 to 5% of the military was made up of green card holders in the 9/11 period.
So what do we know about these immigrant recruits as far as how they compare in skills or education to the average recruit who is an American citizen?
Well, interestingly, they tend to come to the recruiter's office with many fewer problems. So just to give you an example, in order to get a green card, you have to clear all sorts of background checks. A U.S. citizen who comes into a recruiter's office doesn't have to clear any Department of Homeland Security background checks to be a U.S. citizen. So a U.S. citizen might come into a recruiter's office with an extensive criminal record or maybe mental health issues or whatever that green card holders wouldn't have. And that's because a green card holder can't get a green card if they have those issues. So the green card holders tend to be more qualified than the average American citizen recruit just because they've already been screened a lot already by the Department of State and the Department of Homeland Security before they got their green card. There's other people coming into the military that have higher skills who are non-citizens, for example, the MAVNIs, military accessions vital to the national interest. But the green card holders, on average, tend to have they're less likely to have a criminal record. They're more likely to go to basic training after signing a contract. They're less likely to have a criminal record after they join the military. They're less likely to misbehave. They're more likely to re-enlist and make the military a career. There have been studies comparing green card holders to American citizens who join the military, and across the board, the Pentagon has found that they get a better bang for their buck when they recruit a green card holder just because the person is less likely to quit the military after joining. As far as skills go, a lot of them do bring language skills that the military needs. It's much more likely that a green card holder is going to speak a foreign language at a fluent level than a native-born American would.
We're talking with attorney Margaret Stock. She's a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve Military Police Corps, and she's the principal attorney at Cascadia Cross Border Law in Anchorage, Alaska. And we're talking about immigrant recruits to the U.S. military who are being discharged. And now, Margaret, about 10 days ago, the AP reported that some immigrant recruits were being discharged, throwing their status on that path to citizenship into question. What happened?
Well, what happened was that there was a special group of immigrant recruits who had been recruited for their high-level skills. They were either U.S. licensed doctors or they were speakers of certain foreign languages, and they had been recruited through a special recruiting program. The Department of Defense suddenly decided that they needed to do lots of extra background checks on these people above and beyond what anybody had ever done on anyone joining the U.S. government before, and they didn't have the resources to do the background checks. So what happened was thousands of these folks signed enlistment contracts and were told that they were going to be allowed to go to basic training in 6 months, and then the date kept getting pushed off because brand new background checks were instituted and DOD didn't have the resources to do them. At one point last year, DOD said they were going to discharge everybody, but there was a public outcry over that, especially coming from members of Congress. So DOD was forced to back off, and they said, no, we're not going to discharge people. We're going to continue to go forward with their background checks. Then it appeared about a year later, which was a few weeks ago, they were quietly doing what they said they were going to do a year ago, and they started just getting rid of people. The excuse that they used was that people had failed their background check, but they weren't telling their recruits why they had failed. They weren't giving them an opportunity to contest the supposedly derogatory information that was leading to them being discharged. And the whole thing was rather quite suspicious. One recruit filed a lawsuit a couple of weeks ago, and yesterday the Army admitted in court that he was improperly discharged. The Army admitted that they had failed to follow their regulations in discharging a member of the military without giving him a chance to rebut the derogatory information. So things are quite chaotic at the moment because it appears that the discharges that were reported by the AP were unlawful, that the military didn't follow the rules when suddenly discharging all these soldiers. And they've now admitted that in court in the case of one of the recruits.
Has the military made any public statements about why this policy was changed and why they are choosing to discharge these recruits that, as you said, were part of a kind of a special cadre of recruits who had skills that they really needed?
Yes. The public information coming from the Pentagon is that they've suddenly decided that immigrants are dangerous and that foreign militaries and foreign intelligence services could infiltrate the U.S. military through immigrants who are coming in. Now, they haven't explained what has changed suddenly that made them more dangerous than the hundreds of thousands of immigrants who've served since 1775. The U.S. military has had a problem with espionage since 1775. You may have heard of Benedict Arnold. Benedict Arnold, of course, was a native-born American. But the immigrants serving in the military in 1775, certainly people were suspicious and thought, you know, these people might be dangerous. The Pentagon hasn't been able to explain what changed in the last couple of years and why suddenly they're terrified of immigrants entering the military and have suddenly decided that they need to do extreme vetting on immigrants. Mm-hmm. But from all publicly available information, there doesn't seem to be any increased threat at all. The Pentagon hasn't cited any public case of any of these immigrants being charged with a crime or terrorism or being convicted of anything. In contrast, there are dozens and dozens of cases of U.S. citizens in the military who have been charged with espionage and terrorism and serious crimes and so forth. But for some reason, they're not vetting those folks. They're vetting the immigrants only, even though the percentage of immigrants that have caused trouble is much lower, and there's no public cases of these folks doing anything bad.
Well, and one of the reasons it seems that the military has given is that these recruits have foreign, I can't remember if the word was contacts or connections, but by virtue of being an immigrant, that's always going to be the case.
That's correct, and it's a very odd situation where the Pentagon seems to be spending millions of dollars to find out something that they knew already. So they're spending millions of dollars figuring out that somebody has foreign ties, but the person signed an enlistment contract as a foreigner.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew when the person signed the enlistment contract that they had foreign relatives. They were here legally on a visa, so obviously they're not American citizens. And they spent millions of dollars doing vetting, which proved that they were foreigners. And then they're discharging them for having foreign ties. So it's all quite Byzantine and strange, and it demonstrates an extreme amount of mismanagement at the Department of Defense.
And as we wrap up, Margaret, in April, the Army announced that they would not meet their recruiting goals for 2018, and they cited low unemployment and competition from private employers as some of the reasons for not making that benchmark. Would the military be able to fill the holes, both in numbers of people and in skills, that would be left if significant numbers of these immigrant recruits are discharged?
No, the military is not going to be able to meet its goals, and it's just demographics. Immigrants right now are about 13.5% of the U.S. population. So if you're not going to recruit those folks, you're taking 13.5% of the population out of the potential recruiting pool, and that's a huge number of people. It's also a group of people who tend to be more in the lines of the folks the military wants to recruit. If you look at U.S. demographics, without immigration, we're a rapidly aging population, and the percentage of people in the population eligible for military service and the right age for serving in the military has been shrinking. So if you're going to exclude all the immigrants, you're going to have a major recruiting problem, and the only way to fill the ranks is going to be to give waivers to American citizens. So you'd be doing things like increasing your waivers for criminality and mental health problems and drug problems and things like that. And that doesn't help the military to increase the number of folks in the ranks who have bad behavior in their past.
Well, Margaret, thank you so much for helping explain this very complicated issue for us.
Well, thank you for having me on your show. I hope people will pay attention to this issue. It's crucial for the United States military to be able to draw on all talented people in our country, including the immigrants.
That was attorney Margaret Stock. She's a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve Military Police Corps. She's the author of the book Immigration Law and the Military, and she's the principal attorney at Cascadia Cross-Border Law in Anchorage, Alaska. She talked to Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson yesterday. And if this is your story, we'd like to hear from you. If you are an immigrant to the United States and you have served or are serving in the U.S. military, please share your story. How did you make that decision to join the military? What was that experience like? Did it lead you ultimately into American citizenship? Please email us and give us some contact info at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Here's a little mental exercise for you. Think back to the earliest memory of your life, the very first thing you have a distinctive memory of. Take a moment. Okay, got it? Good. Now, here's the bad news. There's a good chance that it didn't really happen. According to a new study in the journal Psychological Science, about 40% of people reported first memories that were probably not true. Researchers surveyed about 6,600 people in the UK and asked them to recall their first memory, describe it in writing, and report their age when the event happened. Now, reading about this, I was hoping that the researchers would then do all sorts of detective work to fact-check those memories. But that'd be really expensive. They did not do that. What they did do was notice that about 40% of the people had claimed their first memories happened between the ages of 0 and 2. And it looks like there's a lot of pretty solid science out there that says, really, we don't genuinely remember anything before age 2, period. So what's going on for those people who remember stuff before age 2? Well, they're not just making stuff up here. What happens, researchers think, is that you hear stories from your family again and again. Oh, when you were little, when you were a baby, when you were one or a toddler or whatever, you did this thing by the green couch that's still there. And then your brain just slowly makes a memory up, and then you start to remember that as your earliest memory. I've got some stories like that about myself. Not time to tell them now. Maybe someday. About Calvin and Hobbes. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.